This session will be with the public information review of IFRS 3, this is combination. And as you all know, public information reviews are a mandatory step to the IFRS 3 resource requirements. And they are normally undertaken through two phases. During the first phase, what we try to do is to identify all of the conceptual and implementation issues that entities have faced when trying to implement this standard. And the first phase finishes with the publication of a request for information, which is the document that includes all of those issues and asks for public comment. The second phase is consists of further outreach, and it also analyzes the comments received and gathers all these findings and conclusions in a final document, which is a feedback statement. And the stages of this post-implementation review, we are about to finalize the first phase of the post-implementation review of IFRS 3. We started the discussions with the board, and this is slide 4 for you in July this year. And the board specifically agreed that the scope of the review was going to be the whole business combination project, meaning IFRS 3 issued in 2004, IFRS 3 issued in 2008, and any consequential amendments as a result of these two standards. This is what the board of the PC agreed, and this is what framed the scope of the review. Slide 6, 7, 8, and 9 summarizes key feedback that we have been receiving during the last month. We have exposed this, the member papers, to the board, and we have gathered all of this feedback into the board papers that will be discussed with the board in November. And we have also put together another paper that includes the tentative questions that we have thought of to be included in the request for information, so that the board also provides us feedback about these tentative questions. The feedback that we have received, as I said, is summarized in this slide. We think that it's, in most of the cases, self-explanatory. And we have thought that because we do have only an hour, the best way to approach this meeting would be to gather your feedback directly without any introduction of the issues that we have been hearing from different constituents. And if you do have a question of any of the items that you don't understand very well what it means, but we prefer your input to understand whether the issues in those slides are relevant for you, whether you would add, modify anything as well. So with that, then I would give the word to you.
Thank you, Maria. Can you thoughts, any feedback that you have to Maria Legislate? Sandra?
Yes. Just encourage you to make sure you stay aligned with the FAS, because it's generally a converged standard. And then during the interpretation committee discussion, it talks about not wanting to get ahead of this, but one of the items that's on their work list, which is when you contribute assets to form a joint venture, if they proceeded with that and the assets were deemed to be business, it would end up resulting in different accounting for US GAAP and IFRS. So I think you have to make sure you're very focused on that and not let things get through the register or will create more differences.
The best particular approach, which makes it very challenging for the faculty itself, because they can't actually use the data that's worth by the best. But with that assurance from the US, they're basically holding back the way they work for us to get our processes. So we're very conscious of trying to get this together as possible.
And then just to add on,
that's
probably the most important issue is the definition of the business. I think that adds a lot of complexity to the application of the standards kind of resolve that you get discussed.
Or remove the arbitrage opportunity by aligning the account, which the board nearly did in 2007. But that, I think that's one of the questions we are asking earlier. Should we try to address the definition of business, or should we try to remove the accounting difference? The fundamental question is, should there be a different account for a bunch of assets versus a business?
Yeah, but then you get into the process of when you're paying cash for assets to go a separate step and spend a lot of time and money to support the cash payment as fair value. So you can't just rely on that. So it adds cost and complexity if you go down that route.
Kenan? When you send out the request for information for the purpose of actual standards, I think there's some specific questions you've got to ask. One, you know, how many day-long games have you actually had in your environment? Because the standard says if you have a day-long game, double check your answer. So my answer guess is that your answer is going to be relatively zero. And if the answer is relatively zero, then you don't need to check your answer. Again, some issues that we have is the measurement of contingent liabilities. When we've done acquisitions where our auditors and the entity that acquired auditors have been the same firm, we have been able to measure contingent liabilities as a liability of those acquisitions because they couldn't be schizophrenic. We found it much simpler to get to a contingent liability with a affirmative indifference. Illogical answer, because it's either is a liability, but where most of the firms are going is that the settlement of the contingent liability is a change of management event and therefore shouldn't be considered as part of the liabilities arising on acquisition, like retrenchments are form part of your liabilities on acquisition. So if the subsidiary manager wasn't going to pay it, it's not a liability. It's also worthwhile going through all of the EITS has been issued on SAS 141 and SAS 141 off. But some of those we may have adopted in IFRS as users, and they might not actually be part of IFRS. In reality, we may have got it wrong. Those are the sorts of things. I can think of them. You know, the contingent consideration in the EITS says you don't include it. And I know we've taken that approach in our IFRS acquisition. And not included contingent consideration as part of our liabilities on the basis of the measurement criteria that's so varied that you couldn't get a reasonable answer. And the idea is all true. But I think the real question of Kevin is that, okay, I respect your comments and they are very relevant, but I think the point that Alan touched on is the, okay, you do that and you bring it in line today, but tomorrow onwards again it's going to go off rails. So I think that's the continuous challenge we have in all kinds of standards. How do we make sure that we continue to be converged?
Is this an intention? Because the theory I'm sitting at, given that I see the differences from the dual reporter, is that are we now saying, let's bring them back online, because they're not the same today.
Yeah, I know that.
So is the two post-implementation reviews intended to bring them back together? That's a bad part, because on that basis it means that every converged standard we've got now has a post-implementation review to bring it back together again. And we can't be on that page.
And it's trying to
get them up there. You shouldn't get there. So I think it's worthwhile listening to their view. But if the right answer is the page that the IAC is on at the moment, we'll be there if we can, but if we can't, we won't. If you've got more than one participant, then it goes to the accounting standards forum. They conclude the US vote loses, and we end up with two different answers.
Olivia?
I think I have understood that if you buy a business at a price that since that time, the sum of the fair value of the assets and liabilities, because in fact you expect to close a factory or something like that, so it will cost you some money in the care, for example. In fact, you will have a value, so you will have this again when you buy the factory, rather business, and then you will have next year a loss because you register the liability because you have decided to close it. So I wonder if it's normal, but it seems for you a good representation to have once the gain and then the loss. And in fact, when you decide to do it that way. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. How many seems different to get first the gain and then the loss?
A few consultants actually have commented on this matter, and what they have said is that sometimes they would like that those gains that have been accounted for based on a bargain purchase, they would think that it would be appropriate to account for gains if it is really a bargain purchase, but not to account for gains if it is because we're going to be having losses in future years. So they are wondering whether recognition of a gain always is consistent with the economic underlying presentation. So yes.
I think you also have to find out whether if all business combinations, goodwill can exist. Because what I call CEO ego shouldn't be goodwill. If you have overpaid, you overpaid. Because if you've underpaid, you call it a bargain purchase. And we recognize it immediately. But if you've overpaid, we allow people to record it as an asset and then use clip accounting as to when you impair it. But a lot of goodwill is actually CEO ego.
It's a hobby, it's a pleasure though.
Well, I work in an environment with wasting assets, so I can easily identify CEO ego. We've got no right.
If the gold isn't there, it ain't there.
One of the practical difficulties associated with sometimes defining reporting something like that. Because form of the company or nature of the company we acquired, it's not the same. Over time, these things totally changed. So of course, if you buy a company different than today, it's very clear, but just over 10 years after, never the same. So how do you define reporting needs? That's a very challenging area for you. I can't find from here, but that's an issue of that issue. And secondly, relating to that, but probably because of relating to that issue, in certain instances, there are cases where amortization, the goodwill may get off, rather than always making a good impairment test because of former nature of the acquired company may not be the same, So at some point I think it worth revisit through certain amortization methods also probably utilized for this kind of thing. Currently always you have to have impairment test. But at some point it's very difficult and very costly, very little for me. So I think that's just a bringing that difference.
Okay, thanks. Malcolm?
So, this is obviously very, if you get comments back to all these questions, it potentially could clearly take several years to resolve. It's a pretty fundamental rewrite of IFRS 3, which perhaps is needed. I'm going to do a quick fix. Just on a more detailed point, I guess when I look on the first page of the conceptual manuscript, the fourth point points out, I guess here you mean the tension between the guidance in IFRS 3 and IFRS 13 on use it as a count.
There is something about this as well. So in the measurement of the value of the significant interest, we have
We talked about it in the past. We had a case where we had a potential minority interest, and then a few years later we squeezed out the final bit and paid over the odds to get the last few shares, and that we had to apply that value to the initial stake on the P times Q basis, which produced ridiculous results. It's not bad. The accounting standard that you end up having to value the whole block, which was a minority block with no particular synergies attached to it, with a value of the squeeze out at the end, which you pay, you're prepared to pay more for because you get the synergies. But you shouldn't, just because you pay more for the last block of shares for the synergies attached, you shouldn't use that value for the initial block. And just my last point was, you know, on the format of going out to get questions,
yes.
I didn't, when you did the last one, which was on the on IFRS 8, it was very, you know, you just send it to the CFO, you wrote it as if only the CFO could respond. We as an organization, when we respond to Swiss Holdings, we have to sort of say, well, I know you didn't intend us to respond. So, presumably, you do intend organizations to respond. So, I would welcome if the format of the request for information, if it makes it clear that, you know, anybody that has a sensible comment should respond.
Yeah, I remember Malcolm raising this issue, even at IFRS 8, and then it went to his CFO.
And I happened to get it because I wasn't scanning the website, perhaps I should have done, but you know, I almost got it by chance. And, you know, you should make sure it's widely distributed.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's trivial because a mixed week. No, people are interested. I don't think we have an email that was set up for after Tudor. We publicly announce it and publish it usually out of conference. We don't send it out to subscribers, and we can print it with words of photographs and we do not back to that.
It's the only difference.
Yeah.
You have a point on this one, Olivia, or something else?
Okay. I just want to know if you have the feeling that people in general have understood the principle when you should recognize 100% of the sale, when you have only sell part of it because you have lost control. It's what we have to do when we
do it. But isn't it IFRS 10 question though?
Yeah. It's not.
If you lose control over this, if you lose control, I have got 10 deals with that, right?
Well, but there were some amendments from IFRS 2 to 2007, and there were some amendments from IFRS 2 to 2008 to IFRS 2007, to the former IFRS 2 to 2007. Operationally, we haven't heard concerns how this should be made. I think there is some discomfort on the conceptual matter of recognizing a gain upon the loss of control, but it's the same as in the step of decision of recognizing a gain for the significant interest when we measure. This is the conceptual maybe controversial to your constituents, but it's not an operational issue of how do we have to do it.
No,
it's
not an operational issue. It is a question about, is it something that is accepted, I would say, that is generally understood by users and by the top management of the corporation. Because my experience is that this is something that no one understood. They are widely applied, because you have to, but no one understands that when you sell a part of business, because it is completed, you have control on and no longer have control on, you have to register 100 of profit and they value the part you had before. I understand the concept myself, but I see that people to whom I explain it, they don't.
So it's just mainly users you're worried about, the people reading space of
that? Users, top management of companies, when they first use it because it's
facility. It's a such a place for people. It's not an application guidance, the way that they use.
Yeah.
Useful, does it make sense?
Yeah.
Perfect. And there's a comment.
I like the way that you divided this up, conceptual matters versus further guidance or clarification. I'd like to mention that you can keep challenging yourself to think about conceptual matters. It's so easy because conceptual matters are so difficult to just go and look at guidance or clarification matters, especially this is a pretty much converged standard. It's difficult to look at conceptual matters, but I think that's one of the purposes of looking at post-implementation review is not just looking at the implementation, if you will, even though that's the name of it, is actually looking at the concept, did they improve financial reporting? Since my experience, in my personal opinion, that the FASB and what they're doing has not done that, has defaulted to implementation type issues. I'm not sure what your experience was and the one you did for IFRS 8 segments, and if you think that you really looked at the conceptual issues, or was it just here are the conceptual issues, but you know, it just got a little too tough and we didn't really look at them. So I constantly challenge yourselves to keep on top of your minds that if the purpose of this is to look at both conceptual issues and implementation issues, that proper thought is to conceptual issues and challenging them. I'm not quite a statement to you, John. We certainly tried to look at how that's good. The difficulty probably was just in terms of timing, you know, to really measure, I think, how informative the change of technical reporting was. You need a slightly longer time period to have a look at market studies, for example. You know, the only thing we've really got is that we know that the number of segments that reported relative to, say, for the US, for example, is different, with much higher number of segments outside of the US. We know that the number of segments increased when we introduced the new standard, which was a surprise to most people. They thought the segment would shrink down. The number of one segment editing dropped as well. And apart, you know, their observations, the idea was to try and make it more formative by increasing your ability to look down inside the organization. So we've got some rough indicators, at least we've got more granular information than we had before. But it takes a bit longer to see whether or not the fact that makes it better pricing, for example. Wouldn't you think like that up, we see that you've got reduced information asymmetry, but again, only very early studies that we've got from academics. So I think Gannon's going to do a little follow-up to that from the team monitor. But that's, we are serious, fundamentally whether we've got the right definition of a difference, for example, but if we've got the right sort of idea, the amount of detail you get for the intangible assets, because to me that's related to the amortization versus impairment. When we move to an impairment model, we then want to pull out as many of the prepaid or the intangibles that essentially going to go away over time. And so you specifically amortize the life, and then you need the impairment for what's left. So it's really important to have a great big goodwill number that we then scatter across a generating unit, but we wanted to pull out as many of the specific things that you've got without causing people to hunt for every final. So it's going to the space, it's quite challenging, and I suppose that the sorts of things we'd like to get feedback on as well. However, the aim of what we do is any fundamental issues like that, we just feed into the next agenda consultation with no expectation that we'll simply say, well, you know, we're a bit unhappy about that, we're just going to jump to a change. That's it.
Maria, then maybe if there are further comments, you might want to talk about the next steps and brief the group about what the next steps are and what.
Yeah.
And get them, like Malcolm's suggestion about making sure that most people are aware of it, unlike the PIR for IFRS 8. I think those are valid comments.
Well, the following step is to present board charter to the board next week. From there, then we will go back to the board in December to present
another version of the questions that would include the feedback for the faculty next week. And from there, then we will publish and request for information either by the end of January or early February. And we will leave time for the delay for public comments. And from there, then we start the second phase of the evaluation. But we'll leave then to the feedback season that will be published in during the first quarter of 2014. This is the plan of the
evaluation. Any thoughts, anything on this before we pass it on to the disclosure initiative? Thank you, Mariela. Thank you. Thank you.